Lecture 23, Who Matters in American History?
Most Americans think they know the names of the great political figures in American history, names such as Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman. There are, however, numerous other political figures whose contributions were just as important, but who, while far from being totally unknown, are far less familiar to most Americans. For events covered in the last few lectures, for example, what about Harry Hopkins, Franklin Roosevelt's right-hand man and virtual alter ego during World War II? Or George Kennan, the head of the State Department policy planning staff, who in 1947 authored the Cold War policy of containment and co-authored the Marshall Plan? Or Matthew Ridgway, the Army Chief of Staff, who played such a critical role in preventing American military intervention in Vietnam in 1954. There are also lesser-known historical figures in realms outside of politics, who, one might argue, are at least as important as any political figures. In this lecture, we will examine the numerous accomplishments of a few such political and non-political individuals and try to understand why, despite those accomplishments, they are less familiar than other figures. Such an analysis will also enable us to explore who in history we choose to remember and why. Let's do politics first. In that political realm, I have chosen one statesman from the 18th, one from the 19th, and one from the 20th century. John Adams, his son John Quincy, and George Catlett Marshall. Although two were presidents, and the third was one of our greatest soldiers and statesmen, and although each was very well known in his time, they are relatively unknown today, especially in comparison to their peers, Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Franklin Roosevelt, Truman, and Eisenhower. After looking at these three, we will then look at some non-political figures in American history and try to figure out why they too are lesser known than our major political figures. In the process, we will also explore the so-called traditional grand narrative of American history and how it is under assault, yet perhaps in the midst of enormous change and expansion. But first, let us look at the three lesser-known political figures, Adams, Quincy Adams, and Marshall. John Adams first. Adams was probably the most important and respected of all the revolutionary leaders from New England. He played a major role in both Continental Congresses. He nominated George Washington to command the Continental Army. He helped to draft the Declaration of Independence, and he drafted the instructions that would result in the wartime Treaty of Alliance with France. He also obtained a critical Dutch loan while a diplomat in Europe during the war. He played a major role in the peace negotiations that ended the war, and he became the first official U.S. representative to Great Britain after the war. He was also a major political theorist. He wrote the Massachusetts Constitution, and, perhaps surprisingly, he defended the British soldiers put on trial as a result of the Boston Massacre. Now, during the Revolution, he had nominated George Washington to command the Continental Army in order to commit the Southern colonies to a conflict that then centered on Boston. Similarly, he was elected as our first vice president, partially to provide a sectional balance to Washington, the Virginian, in the new government. He was the obvious choice to succeed Washington as president, but he inherited a diplomatic crisis with France, as well as a growing partisan rift at home, with the opposition led by none other than his vice president and old friend, Thomas Jefferson. The crisis with France erupted into an undeclared naval war in 1798 that the Hamiltonian wing of his own Federalist Party wanted to turn into a full-scale declared war. Such a war, when combined with the recently passed Alien and Sedition Acts, which virtually outlawed dissent, would have guaranteed Adams' re-election. though it also could have led to a civil war. But Adams refused to agree. He never filled the ranks of the special army Congress had agreed to create. And when France proposed negotiations to end the conflict, he quickly agreed. He also fired the Hamiltonian members of his cabinet when he discovered that they were subverting his plans to negotiate an end to rather than an expansion of the war. As a result of his moves, he was able to obtain peace with France, but at the cost of splitting his Federalist Party and thus dooming his own re-election attempt against Jefferson. Adams realized the political cost of his behavior, but he considered it the most meritorious actions of his life. "I will defend my missions to France," he wrote, "as long as I have an eye to direct my hand or a finger to hold my pen. They are the most disinterested and meritorious actions of my life. I reflect upon them with so much satisfaction that I desire no other inscription over my gravestone than 'Here lies John Adams, who took upon himself the responsibility of the peace with France in the year 1800. But the cost was not limited to the election of 1800. As the only one of the five founding fathers elected president but not reelected for a second term, he became the forgotten one. Fittingly, he died on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, as did Thomas Jefferson, his old friend who had become his political enemy but with whom he had eventually reconciled. His final words, "Thomas Jefferson still lives." Jefferson, however, had died just a few hours earlier. Equally fitting, Adams once summarized and explained his own career by explaining to his wife Abigail that, as he put it, "I must study politics and war, that my sons may have the liberty to study mathematics and philosophy, navigation, commerce, and agriculture, in order to give their children a right to study painting, poetry, music, and porcelain." David McCullough, Joseph Ellis, and others have over the past few decades done their best to give Adams his due, and he is now better known than he previously had been. Nevertheless, he remains relatively unknown to the public, especially in comparison to his peers, Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, Madison. Now, on Adams' death in 1826, his son, John Quincy Adams, was in the midst of his own largely forgotten presidency. Yet, like his father, he had had a brilliant career before he became president, primarily as a diplomat. He had helped to negotiate the Treaty of Ghent that had ended the War of 1812. He had also served as minister, really ambassador, to the Netherlands, to Prussia, to Russia, and to Great Britain. He had then been appointed by James Monroe as Secretary of State. In these roles, Adams had been responsible for some of the most important treaties and announcements in the history of U.S. foreign relations. The Rush-Bagot Agreement to limit naval forces on the Great Lakes, which was the first naval arms limitation agreement in modern history, and the start of what would eventually become the famous undefended Canadian-American border. The Boundary Convention of 1818 that established a boundary with Canada all the way to the Rocky Mountains, as well as joint Anglo-American occupation of the Oregon Territory and thus a U.S. claim to the Pacific Coast. The Adams-Onis Transcontinental Treaty of 1819, by which the United States acquired Spanish Florida and a clear continental boundary with the Spanish Empire all the way to the West Coast. That also established an American claim to the Pacific coast, and it is a treaty that ranks in importance with the Louisiana Purchase of 1803. Finally, the famous Monroe Doctrine that Adams, rather than Monroe, actually authored. Perhaps one reason Adams remains relatively unknown is that most of these diplomatic achievements remain relatively unknown. Adams became president in 1825, but he did so via a unique route that would plague and doom his presidency. Since none of the numerous candidates for president had received a majority of the votes in the Electoral College, or in the popular vote for that matter, the election was decided by the House of Representatives, with each state casting one vote. Now, as noted in a previous lecture, the choice boiled down to Adams or Andrew Jackson. Eliminated from the race by his low vote total, Speaker of the House Henry Clay of Kentucky encouraged his supporters to vote for Adams, even though Jackson had more electoral votes and more popular votes. Clay's support ensured Adams' election, whereupon he appointed Clay Secretary of State, the position traditionally seen and used as the stepping stone to the presidency. Jackson and his supporters screamed corrupt bargain, which it was not, and they immediately began a campaign to win the election of 1828 and, in the process, subvert Adams' presidency. In this, they were successful, and Adams was defeated in his 1828 re-election bid. Unlike his father, however, Adams did not allow this defeat to end his political career. He agreed to run for and won election two, the House of Representatives from his home district, commenting that being so elected by your neighbors was an honor higher than the presidency. And in the House of Representatives, he became a fierce opponent of slavery and its expansion. He also acted to subvert the gag rule that had barred anti-slavery petitions from Congress. And he defended the right of slaves who had taken over their slave ship, the Amistad, to their freedom. He also opposed the annexation of Texas and the war with Mexico. In the process, he developed the nickname Old Man Eloquent. In 1848, he suffered a massive stroke while speaking out against that war, and he was carried out of the House chamber, dying 2 days later. Unlike the two Adamses, George Catlett Marshall was never elected president, but only because he chose not to run. In 1939, Franklin Roosevelt appointed him Army Chief of Staff over 33 senior officers. He held that post from the day Hitler invaded Poland to begin World War II, September 1, 1939, to the end of that war. During that time, he created a huge and highly successful army and air force of over 8.25 million men, by far the largest army in U.S. history. In the process, he won the respect and the admiration of Congress, the American people, America's wartime allies, and his colleagues on both the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Anglo-American Combined Chiefs of Staff, where he quickly emerged as the first among equals. Churchill called him the true organizer of Allied victory. Marshall was the obvious choice to command Operation Overlord, the 1944 invasion of France and the largest amphibious operation in history. But questions arose as to whether he could be spared from Washington, for he was, in effect, running the global U.S. war effort. Nevertheless, the command was his for the asking. But he refused to ask. When Roosevelt asked, "Do you want the command?" Marshall responded that Roosevelt, as president, had to do what was best for the country, not what was best for George C. Marshall. Roosevelt then chose Marshall's protege, Dwight D. Eisenhower, for the command, commenting to Marshall that he, quote, "could not sleep at night with you out of the country." The Overlord command and his success at it guaranteed Eisenhower historical immortality and the presidency in 1952. "You have never thought of yourself," Secretary of War Henry Stimson told Marshall on VE Day in May of 1945. And he continued, "There is no one for whom I have such deep respect and, I think, greater affection. I have seen a great many soldiers in my day," Stimson movingly concluded, "and you, sir, are the finest soldier I have ever known." Stimson was far from alone in that judgment. In late 1945, President Harry Truman, who considered Marshall the, quote, "greatest living American," appointed him special emissary to China in a hopeless effort to avert a civil war. Then in early 1947, he appointed Marshall Secretary of State. Marshall proved to be one of the great secretaries of state, even though he served only 2 years. He established the containment policy in the Cold War, and as part of it, the European Recovery Program that bears his name as the Marshall Plan. For that, he received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1953, the first professional soldier ever to win that prestigious award. Marshall also established a bipartisan foreign policy with a Republican Congress and a Democratic president that lasted for 20 years. Nor was that the end of it. In September of 1950, at the age of nearly 70, he agreed to become Secretary of Defense in order to rebuild the U.S. Army for the Korean War. He also ended the inter-service feuding that had erupted into the so-called Revolt of the Admirals a year earlier, and he reestablished good civil-military relations with the State Department, which had become badly frayed. He also played a key role in the 1951 relief of General Douglas MacArthur in what many consider the greatest threat to civilian control of the military in U.S. history. Now, throughout this extraordinary career, Marshall utterly refused to run for political office or even to vote. When asked for his political faith, he would respond that, quote, "My father was a Democrat, my mother a Republican, and I am an Episcopalian." Nevertheless, he came under savage political attack in 1950 and 1951 by Joseph McCarthy and his supporters for the, quote, loss of China and MacArthur's relief. Another senator, William Jenner, labeled him, quote, "a living lie and a front man for traitors." When Marshall died in 1959, he nevertheless remained one of the most respected men in the country. But his reputation faded as the generation that knew him passed away. When I ask students today if they know who George Marshall was, most say no. And the few who respond in the affirmative can only say, indeed, ask, he had something to do with the Marshall Plan, didn't he? Well, why then are these great statesmen lesser known than many of their peers? For Adams, a major reason is that he followed George Washington into the presidency. And to say Washington was a tough act to follow is a major understatement. He was also an argumentative and often a disagreeable person, and a one-term president defeated for re-election by none other than the author of the Declaration of Independence, his former friend Thomas Jefferson. He could have defeated Jefferson and had a second term by turning the quasi-war against France into a full-fledged war. But he refused to do so because it violated his principles, which he would not do, especially for political gain. As with his defense of British soldiers on trial for the Boston Massacre, he was indeed, as per the title of one biography, Honest John Adams. His son John Quincy possessed a similar, if not even more difficult, personality. "I am a man of reserved, cold, austere, and forbidding manners," he wrote. "My political adversaries say a gloomy misanthropist, and my personal enemies an unsocial savage." One historian, George Dangerfield, has concluded that Adams was peculiarly fitted for public service, except in one respect. As Dangerfield wrote, Adams was almost totally deficient in the art of getting on with other people. Adams also followed into the presidency the last of the founding fathers, James Monroe. He was a one-term president, and he was defeated for re-election by the immensely popular and studied Andrew Jackson. Quincy Adams was also the only president to be selected by the House of Representatives, and under circumstances that led many Americans at the time to question whether he ever should have become president. In addition, much of his prior brilliant success as a diplomat and secretary of state was hidden from the public view, and it remains hidden to this very day. Now, Marshall also possessed what many have described as a forbidding personality. Nevertheless, he could have easily been elected president after World War II had he agreed to run, for he was clearly the most respected man in the country for his wartime work. But he refused to do so, much as he has refused to ask Roosevelt for the Overlord Command. As a result, he never achieved battlefield fame. That honor, and with it the presidency and historical immortality, went to his protege, Eisenhower. The name of the European Recovery Program, in his honor, is what he is most remembered for by those who recognize his name at all. But it is merely the tip of an iceberg of accomplishments. Now, one common factor that may account for the relative obscurity of these three individuals today, despite their enormous accomplishments during the eras in which they lived, is their refusal to allow personal political ambition to control their behavior or to violate their sense of what was right. Another may have been their utter honesty and refusal to compromise that honesty for political gain. Honest John Adams, Marshall, a reputation for never lying to Congress. A third may have been their knowledge of history and their subsequent ability to take the long view regarding what was truly important. For Adams, that was peace with France in 1800 over re-election. For his son, John Quincy Adams, it was first the geographic expansion of his country without war, and then the crusade against slavery and for civil liberties. And for Marshall, it was the preservation of a truly democratic society in the midst of a global war. That is perhaps best illustrated not only by his refusal to lie to Congress, but by his charge in early 1943 to General John Hildreth, the officer he had appointed to head a new civil affairs division in the Army General Staff that was to train military governors for occupied enemy territory. Marshall's charge to Hildreth was never to forget that he was being handed what he called a sacred trust, the fact that the American people trusted their army officers. And Hildreth could destroy that trust overnight, Marshall warned. It could happen if he did not understand this. This is my principal charge to you, Marshall said. This is the thing I never want you to forget in the dust of battle and when the pressures will be on you. A fourth factor that may account for the relative obscurity of all three was the strong belief each had in the concept of selfless public service. And that belief may have precluded them from actively seeking the publicity and popularity necessary for lasting fame. But let us expand our analysis further to explore not only why we tend to remember certain political figures and not others, but also why we tend to remember political figures at all, as opposed to figures whose accomplishments lay outside the political realm. What about great religious leaders and theologians like Jonathan Edwards, Charles G. Finney, Reinhold Niebuhr? What about economic and technological leaders from Eli Whitney to Steve Jobs? What about black civil rights leaders from Frederick Douglass to Martin Luther King Jr. and James Farmer? And what about feminist leaders from Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton through Betty Friedan, author of The Feminine Mystique, and Gloria Steinem? In this regard, who matters most to us from a given past era may vary depending upon what we wish to know about that era. These figures who I named are all very well known to historians who specialize in U.S. religious, economic, civil rights, or women's history, as opposed to political history. But beyond that rather obvious fact, many of the figures I named come from relatively recent fields of historical study that developed during and after the 1960s and 70s as part of the new social history, a history of groups that had been left out of the traditional grand narrative of the United States, a narrative that had focused on white male political leaders. In the process, these new historians transformed and continue to transform the study of U.S. history. These historians also played a major role in the destruction of the traditional grand narrative of U.S. history. For minorities and women have histories of their own that do not appear to fit the political history of white men in that narrative. Or don't they? One could argue, for example, that the 20th century theologian Reinhold Niebuhr was at least as important in the emergence of the United States as a superpower as Franklin D. Roosevelt and Harry Truman, essentially for his religious concepts regarding the nature of power and the need to grasp it to do good while simultaneously recognizing human limits and the corrupting nature of power. Niebuhr attacked isolationism in the 1930s as immoral in the face of Nazism. He also attacked it after World War II in the face of communism. And he argued that isolationism was an attempt to maintain moral purity, which he considered impossible for a Christian, by refusing to accept the responsibilities of power. But Niebuhr also attacked American efforts in the Cold War to remake the world in its own image. He considered this an example of arrogance and the corrupting influence of power, and he pressed for a recognition of human limits. Or as he phrased it in his famous prayer, "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." George F. Kennan, who worked under Marshall as head of the policy planning staff in the State Department and who authored the U.S. Cold War policy of containment, referred to Niebuhr as, quote, "the father of us all." And he even invited Niebuhr into meetings of the policy planning staff. One could similarly argue that the second Great Awakening revivalist preacher, Charles G. Finney, was at least as important, if not more important, than any of the presidents of his era. Why? Because of the link he preached between religious conversion and political reform, and the enormous political as well as societal consequences that that had, including, but by no means limited, as we have seen in a previous lecture, to the anti-slavery crusade that led to the Civil War. Or in the First Great Awakening, the minister Jonathan Edwards. One could argue he and his colleagues were more important than any of the revolutionary era political leaders because their work for the first time created a common bond between the 13 colonies and led many to question established authority for the first time. Shifting to economics, one could maintain that Eli Whitney was more important than any political figures in causing the Civil War, not only for his well-known invention of the cotton gin, which had an enormous impact on Southern slavery, but also for his equally enormous impact on Northern industry via his pioneering work in the early 19th century to mass-produce muskets for the U.S. Army via interchangeable parts. Whitney is far less well-known for that, but it is, one might argue, just as important as the cotton gin. Similarly, one could claim that industrial and financial leaders from the late 19th century through the entire 20th century were more important in America's rise to superpower status than any generals or admirals or presidents. For the foundation of U.S. military power in the 20th century was its economic power that these men had helped to create. One could also claim that pioneers in the struggle for minority rights and women's rights from the pre-Civil War years through the entire 20th century were more important than the presidents, legislators, and judges responsible for government actions in these realms. Why? Because they changed people's consciousnesses. They mobilized people, and they thereby pressured politicians into action. Now, while our grand narrative, our old grand narrative, is thus dated and fractured, a new one may not only be possible, but actually forming right now. One that synthesizes all of the new histories with the old one to give us a much fuller, more informative, and more useful picture of our past.
Lecture 24. History did not begin with us.
There's an apparent tendency to believe that history either began or was dramatically altered during our lifetimes. A few examples. Many believe the Vietnam War spawned the first major anti-war movement in U.S. history during the 1960s, and that established the precedent for opposition to U.S. war since then. Many also believe that the 1960s gave birth to the civil rights movement, and similarly that the women's movement began in the 1970s. More recently, many have argued that the personal computer is the most important invention in U.S. history, if not in world history, and that with it, we have entered an utterly new era. More broadly, many argue that the pace of change is accelerating at an unprecedented rate and is influencing every aspect of our lives, and not always for the better. Now, some of these statements are simply incorrect. The anti-war and civil rights movements did not begin during the 1960s, nor did the women's movement begin in the 1970s. And the validity of the other statements regarding the computer and the pace of change are subject to severe questioning given a careful reading of U.S. history. In this final lecture, we shall explore the historical realities that challenge these incorrect or questionable beliefs, as well as why so many Americans tend to believe them. Let's look at the anti-war movement first. Contrary to popular belief, Vietnam was not the first American war opposed by many Americans. The Revolution and War for Independence were in all likelihood not supported by a majority of the colonists. Now, there were no public opinion polls at the time. But John Adams claimed that one-third favored the revolution, one-third opposed it, and one-third were neutral. In the 1798 to 1800 quasi-war with France, one of the two major political parties, Jefferson's Democratic Republicans, opposed the war, and they responded to wartime attacks on their civil liberties, the Alien and the Sedition Acts, with the doctrine of nullification in their Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. The result was nearly a civil war. The War of 1812 was opposed by an entire section of the nation, New England, and the other major political party, the Federalists. The war vote in June of 1812 revealed a badly divided nation. 79 to 49 in the House, 19 to 13 in the Senate, with all Federalists and most of New England voting no. New England states also refused to allow their militias to participate in attempted invasions of Canada during the war, and they continued their wholesale smuggling across the Canadian border that had been in effect since Jefferson's embargo in 1806 and 7. There was even talk of secession. And at the Hartford Convention in late 1814, the Federalists proposed a series of states' rights-oriented constitutional amendments designed to limit the power of both the South and the national government. Major sectional and partisan opposition also existed to the 1846 to 48 war with Mexico. Many Northerners and many Whigs condemned the war as one of aggression designed to expand slavery. Indeed, by 1848, the Whigs were threatening to cut off funds for continuation of the war, which may have been a factor in President James K. Polk's decision to accept a peace treaty that acquired California and New Mexico rather than all of Mexico. And as noted in a previous lecture, a one-term Whig congressman from Illinois named Abraham Lincoln obtained the nickname Spotty for challenging Polk to identify the spot where American blood had supposedly been shed upon American soil. Now, mythology to the contrary, major opposition to the Civil War existed in both North and South. Lincoln was a minority president. He had won less than 40% of the popular vote, and there was major opposition to his policies in the North as well as the South. Indeed, Lincoln's administration became notorious for its violations of the civil liberties of those opponents during the war. That included the arrest and deportation of a pro-Southern former congressman in Ohio. And Lincoln came very close to being defeated for re-election in 1864 by one of his former generals, George McClellan, who ran as a Democrat, the party that included a large number of peace supporters. The South was also badly divided into pro- and anti-slavery factions, as well as secession versus Union factions. West Virginia seceded from Virginia over this. Now, there was no opposition to speak of during the brief 1898 war with Spain, but there was plenty of opposition to President McKinley's ensuing decision to acquire an overseas empire, a colonial empire, as a result of that war. The Treaty of Paris ending the war and formalizing the acquisition of the empire faced major opposition in the Senate and in the public. You had the formation of the bipartisan anti-imperialist league and acidic criticisms from such notable Americans as Mark Twain. The Senate accepted the treaty, but only by a vote of 57 to 27, barely the two-thirds needed for ratification. Even more opposition arose to the ensuing war with the Filipinos, who desired independence rather than merely to trade one colonial master for another. There were revelations of American torture of the Filipino guerrillas, leading to congressional investigation and denunciations of the army and the administration. Major opposition also existed in regard to American entry into World War I in 1917, even though the war vote passed the Senate and House by the overwhelming majorities of 82-6 and 373-50. And in 1935, Marine Major General Smedley Butler, who had participated in military actions in the Philippines, in China, in numerous Central American and Caribbean countries, as well as France during World War I, proclaimed that during his 33-plus years in active military service, he had spent, quote, most of my time as a high-class muscle for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. And Smedley Butler was, at this point, the most highly decorated officer in U.S. history. Now, while there was virtually no opposition to our entry into World War II after the Pearl Harbor attack and the Nazi declaration of war, there had been plenty of opposition to Roosevelt's pre-Pearl Harbor policies, most notably aid to Britain, policies that his numerous anti-interventionist critics claimed would lead the United States into an unnecessary war. Opposition also existed to major U.S. policies in the early days of the Cold War, with former Vice President Henry Wallace and the Progressive Party challenging Truman in the 1948 election. Even during the supposedly placid 1950s, major anti-nuclear and pacifist movements existed. There was also opposition to the Korean War, though not anti-war opposition per se. Rather, there were Republican attacks on President Truman for executive war-making without the consent of Congress and on his limited war strategy. Instead, many Republicans backed General MacArthur's calls for an expanded war against China. Interestingly, similar dissent occurred during the Vietnam War, with those calling for escalation and expansion of the war outnumbering those who favored de-escalation and or withdrawal before 1968. That history has in turn been relatively ignored in the new historical emphasis on anti-war movements. Now, why was this long history of major anti-war movements forgotten by most Americans? Partially, it got buried in an outpouring of patriotism after the Pearl Harbor attack and by the bipartisan foreign policy during the early years of the Cold War. Related to this was the anti-communist hysteria during the 1950s that stifled dissent. Furthermore, all these previous anti-war movements failed, including, contrary to mythology, the Vietnam anti-war movement, save perhaps in the sense of avoiding even more escalation. And we tend to spend more time studying successes than failures. In terms of specific wars, many of the loyalists during the Revolutionary War fled the country and resettled in England or Canada. In doing so, they deprived the United States of the people who would have written the anti-war history of that conflict. Federalist demands and threats at the 1814 Hartford Convention became public news after the arrival of the peace treaty that ended the war and Andrew Jackson's smashing victory at New Orleans. And it led to the demise of the Federalists as a national party soon thereafter. That served as a warning to future politicians never to risk open dissent against the war. And as discussed in a previous lecture, some presidents manipulated the facts so as to minimize anti-war dissent and force dissenters to vote for war. James K. Polk, for example, had his supporters attach the war vote as a rider to an appropriations bill for the army then under attack by Mexico along the Rio Grande. How are you going to oppose that? The government also actively suppressed many of these anti-war movements, especially those during the Civil War and World War I. And in suppressing them, it wound up also suppressing their history. And the bipartisan foreign policy and anti-communist hysteria of the 1950s created an environment in which consensus school historians, such as Lewis Hartz and Daniel Boorstin, tended to emphasize the lack of conflict in American history rather than the conflicts. The civil rights movement had an equally long history. For African Americans, it began with the anti-slavery movement itself that started in the mid to late 18th century and accelerated in the 1830s. Simultaneously, free blacks fought against segregation laws in the northern states. So did black leaders like Frederick Douglass and their white supporters before the Civil War, during the Civil War, and after the Civil War. Now, black leader Booker T. Washington did give up on such rights in his famous Atlanta Compromise of 1895, but he did so only temporarily in order to obtain white support for improving the economic condition of African Americans. And he was almost immediately challenged by other black leaders, such as W.E.B. Du Bois. Indeed, Du Bois would help to found the NAACP in the early 20th century. And that organization would begin to challenge Southern segregation laws and other denials of black civil rights throughout the first half of the 20th century. This effort would culminate legally in the famous 1954 Supreme Court case of Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, a case in which the court, by a 9-0 vote, declared segregation unconstitutional. But there had been many previous years of litigation and court decisions leading up to this moment. The equally important court insistence that desegregation occur, quote, with all deliberate speed, occurred only a year later. So did the critical Montgomery bus boycott, which brought to public attention a young black minister named Martin Luther King Jr. Now, why was most of this history forgotten by so many Americans before the 1960s? The plight of free blacks and their efforts to obtain their civil rights before the Civil War tended to be forgotten amidst the much larger and more basic struggle at that time against slavery. The movement for black civil rights after the Civil War failed, despite the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution during the Reconstruction era. And as was stated in regard to the anti-war movement, we tend to spend more time studying successes than failures. In addition, white America as a whole was racist and did not support equal rights for blacks, either before the Civil War or in the century following it. Indeed, segregation laws and other denials of black civil rights occurred in the North as well as the South before the Civil War, and de facto segregation existed in the North throughout the 20th century. Consequently, there was little interest in the history of the struggle for black civil rights outside of the African American community. Finally, The consensus historians of the early Cold War years tended to downplay, if not ignore, the struggle, much as they had ignored previous anti-war movements. The women's movement also has a lengthy history in this country. As noted in a previous lecture, it began within the abolitionist movement of the 1830s over the issue of women speaking in public at anti-slavery rallies and serving in leadership positions. That led to the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention and the birth of the movement for equal rights for women, a movement spearheaded by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and Susan B. Anthony. The key issue during this time was the right to control their own property and wages and the right to vote. That struggle would last more than 70 years. During the Reconstruction era, the women's movement pressed for inclusion in the 14th and 15th Amendments that guaranteed black males their rights. But that effort was unsuccessful. And throughout the late 19th and early 20th centuries, women pressed to obtain the right to vote. They were finally successful with the passage in 1920 of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. They also achieved symbolic moves towards equality with Franklin Roosevelt's appointment to the first female cabinet member, Frances Perkins, as Secretary of Labor, and the political redefinition of the role of First Lady by Eleanor Roosevelt during the 1930s. And during World War II, the Women's Army Corps was established under a female colonel, Ovetta Culp Hobby, and women obtained jobs in a host of occupations previously closed to them and symbolized by Rosie the Riveter. Now, why then was this history lost in the years following World War II? The situation that women found themselves in during World War II was generally perceived in the country as a temporary aberration caused by the exigencies of war and the temporary removal of millions of men from the workforce for military duty. During the Depression and New Deal, working women were perceived, as they would be again after the war, as taking jobs away from men. In addition to that, the combination of the Great Depression and World War II had led many women to postpone having children, a postponement that ended with the end of World War II and led to the post-war baby boom. And with that baby boom, a reassertion of women's traditional roles as mother and housekeeper. That reassertion of traditional roles in turn made the previous history of the early women's rights movement appear largely irrelevant. Now, why were these three histories rediscovered in the 1960s and 1970s? As with most movements, members of these three movements in the 60s and 70s searched for a usable past, and they found it in these previous histories. At numerous teach-ins during the 1960s, professors and students challenged the myth of past wartime consensus, and with that myth, implicit attacks upon their patriotism, by bringing up these previous anti-war movements, as well as challenging the government's version of the history of the Vietnam War. Civil rights activists similarly challenged prevailing racial stereotypes and values. Stereotypes of docile and inferior blacks who had always accepted inferior status. Feminists challenged prevailing gender stereotypes and values and the idea that women had in the past docilely accepted their inferior status. And that in turn led a new generation of scholars to explore these histories in great depth and to produce a rich literature about them. That in turn has altered our views of American history. It also affected the ensuing development of the anti-war, civil rights, and women's movements, movements that are now aware of their past history. So what we see, once again, both in the burying of the history of previous movements and in their rediscovery and expansion, is how the present influences our knowledge and views of the past. The search for what has been labeled a usable past often results in a powerful beam lighting up previously neglected history, and in such a way as to alter our view of the past. Women's history, for example, did not even exist as a field of study in the 1960s. That does not mean women did not have a history. Of course they did. But it took the modern women's movement to rediscover and expand that history. History in this regard is not an objective and unchanging discipline that studies simply the facts about a dead past. Instead, it is a subjective and constantly evolving study of an alive and constantly changing past that is heavily influenced by the questions each generation asks of it in light of contemporary concerns. As a result, history tells us much about ourselves in the present as well as the past that is being studied. Now, what about our present belief that the personal computer is the most important invention in U.S. history, if not in world history, that it has ushered in a new era in history, and that the pace of change is accelerating at an unprecedented rate and influencing every aspect of our lives, and not always for the better? Is that true? Ironically, the belief that change is accelerating at an unprecedented rate is itself far from new. Alvin Toffler, in his 1970 book, Future Shock, propounded such a view many years before the personal computer revolution. In addition, a careful examination of American history reveals a series of fundamental technological changes long before the computer, each one considered at the time the most important and consequential in history. Now, each of these did produce profound changes in American life, and each was touted at the time as the most important and profound, as well as ushering in change so rapid as to be overwhelming. First, the steamboat in 1807 and the canal boom, 3,300 miles of canals by the 1840s, that tremendously sped up transportation and communication. Before this, transportation had been limited by the course of a river, its current, and the inability to move back upstream, save by rowing or poling. The trip from Pittsburgh to New Orleans, for example, had previously taken 1 month to get downstream and 4 months to get back. What did canals do? The 363-mile-long Erie Canal, built between 1817 and 1825, cut the cost of sending a ton of produce from Buffalo to New York City from 20 days to 6. And the cost from $100 a ton to $5 a ton, or from 20 to 30 cents per ton per mile to 2 to 3 cents per mile. It also created a direct water route from the Midwest and from the Midwest to New England and northeastern ports with access to European markets. In short, it opened the Midwest to settlement and economic development. And as all of this flowed into New York City, it made New York City the largest city in the United States. And then came the railroad, the first major improvement in land transportation since the invention of the wheel. Ralph Waldo Emerson, taking his first ride on a train, commented, quote, "Distance is annihilated." Railroad construction began in the U.S. in the 1830s, and it then exploded. By 1840, there were 3,300 miles of track. By 1850, 8,879. By 1860, 30,000 miles. Now, beyond transportation and communication, the railroad deeply affected our agriculture, our industry, our westward expansion, our politics, our warfare, our culture, even our language. Words such as sidetracked, full head of steam, uncoupled, railroaded. And the railroad was perceived as altering everything and creating a new age. Indeed, it even led to the creation of our time zones, which previously had not existed. The same can be said about mass production, from the first assembly line factories that began to replace cottage or household manufacturing with power-driven machines replacing hand-operated tools. At about the same time came the staggering, almost instant communication of the telegraph. 1844, in Samuel Morse's famous first words tapped out on that instrument, "What hath God wrought?" Then came the internal combustion engine and the automobile, which had equally, if not more, profound consequences in each of these areas, as has been previously explored. Consequences that, in effect, remade the nation. Then came the airplane, which first revolutionized warfare and then domestic and international travel and trade. And then nuclear weapons and power, which transformed warfare, technology, values, and culture in ways we are still trying to understand. So is the computer any different, or is it just another major change? And perhaps one not nearly as significant and altering as these earlier ones. Imagine for a moment a man who had been born on a Midwestern farm between 1835 and 1840, and who lived into his mid to late 80s. Think about the incredibly dramatic and life-altering changes he experienced. As a child or teenager, he would have seen and perhaps experienced his first railroad and would have been staggered by its speed, much as Emerson was. He might have also visited the local telegraph office and been astounded by this near-instant communication. As a young man in his 20s, he would have fought in the Civil War and thereby experienced what many historians consider the first modern and total war. As a young married man, he then would have experienced the Industrial Revolution, first on his own farm in terms of mechanization and transportation, and then in all likelihood in the city into which he moved, perhaps Chicago, which had hardly existed when he was born. Whether out of choice or necessity, given the plight of American farmers at the time, he would probably become an urban dweller. The Industrial Revolution and the move to the city would dramatically transform virtually every aspect of his life. And by the end of the century or the beginning of the next, he and his children would probably be using a telephone and have seen an automobile. By the 1920s, they would have been able to purchase one. That would transform his life and that of his family even further. So would a host of new devices that could be purchased and run by electricity in his home. And of course, that included the radio by which he now received his news and entertainment. He would also see, with the Wright brothers' success, and be staggered by the airplane, the fulfillment of a dream as old as human history, the ability to fly like a bird. He would have also seen, and perhaps his grandchildren would have fought in, the largest and most costly war in human history, what they thought and hoped would be the war to end all wars, World War I. Are we really experiencing technological changes more rapid, dramatic, and life-transforming than this individual did? Or is the belief that we are a distortion or a conceit caused by our ignorance of history? Or by the syndrome known as tunnel vision, whereby the past right in front of us as we enter a tunnel appears longer and more important than the bulk of the tunnel, in this case, the entire past before we were born. Now, this is a common human trait that can be overcome only by a knowledge of history and an understanding of its complexities that this course has hopefully provided. Does all of this mean I and other historians think history does repeat itself after all and that the present offers nothing new? Not at all. History does not repeat itself, save perhaps in terms of the emotions that drive human beings to behave in certain ways, love, anger, fear. And thus, there is a repetition in terms of patterns of human behavior. But history never repeats itself in terms of events. Each event is unique, as is each era in human history. And as is each new interpretation of the past that arises within each era, historical interpretation is always linked to specific eras. Always try, as we did especially in the lecture on the causes of the Civil War, to think of history as neither a single straight line or as a circle, the two most common methods of viewing the past, but instead as a spiral. Remember, I suggested visualizing such a spiral with a classroom blackboard as the event and time as three-dimensional and running to the back of the room and beyond. Via this analogy, we are separate from all past events and thus unique, but we are also linked to them in a multidimensional time stream of which we are a part. And being linked, we simultaneously see that history did not begin with us and will not end with us either. Now, this course has discussed only some of the many myths that abound in U.S. history. I hope you've gained facts and insights you didn't have before, and that it has encouraged you to be a skeptic yourself, to challenge other historical myths, and to search for the truth behind those myths.